the second, at Don Stevens, continuing the interview. Last time we basically covered your birth, days in the farm, coming to Grand Rapids. Today we're going to pick up with World War II, and we'll see how far we get. I forgot, I don't have the a release form. I'll get it to you a little bit later on today's interview.
That's okay. As far as that's concerned.
You've got a number of...
Do you want me to set that in a cooler for you?
No, that's just fine.
Would you want some tea? I guess my wife's got some
that's
tea.
That's why I picked this up.
We can have some tea for lunch, though.
Yeah. You've got a number of folders and things that'll maybe help guide us with the story here.
Yeah. Some of these are marked. Some of them aren't. But that if they aren't, I can get a pretty good idea.
Okay. What's the earliest things you have? Do you have anything at the beginning of the war for relates to you? Your induction papers or anything?
Yeah, I have this, yes. You got that on?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes, as we've stated previously, the organization of our local in Grand Rapids and in western and northern Michigan started in 1941. That, of course, was the same year Pearl Harbor, and they... Finally, after Pearl Harbor, when the draft started taking effect and they started calling eligible males to the service, there were several classifications. As I recall, and the document I have here doesn't say what the classifications were, but as I recall, there was A, and there was A1, A2, A3, and so forth. Well, because of the emergency and the elimination of gasoline rationing, and tires were being rationed because of the shortage of rubber and all that sort of thing. The delivery of milk was considered we were deferred. Most of us who were in milk delivery, especially if we had wholesale delivery to stores. The route I had was mostly to homes, but about a quarter of the delivery was to grocery stores, and it was deemed that it was essential to get milk to the people, to the stores, because that was part of keeping society going, I guess. So we were not called up as early as some of the others, but they kept changing the requirements, and finally they changed it. The first change was that anyone under a certain age, and I think it was between the draft age 18 and 30 or whatever it was, our job was reclassified, so it was not as essential, and they started drafting the people, guys that were in the same kind of work that I was, delivering milk.
Still in 42?
No, this wasn't until about 40, almost 44. They changed it a couple of times, but in 44 they changed it so that I was eligible. Now, I had one of the reasons that I was exempt, or some of my co-workers were not exempt, was because we had one daughter that was born before Pearl Harbor. And if you had a child that was born before Pearl Harbor, that gave you some added exemption. But then things started getting tight, and they raised the age way up to about 39 or 40. And I was, I think, only about... Let me turn that off.
I wouldn't mind if we... Because it'll pick that up. You don't need to shut it, it's just it'll pick up that...
Shut that door.
And that's okay. You switched chairs this time, too. Is that the comfortable chair?
I think I'll get that up.
It doesn't look as comfortable.
I'll use it to the desk because it'll slide under the desk. And it was in 1944, early in 1944, they changed, as I recall, they changed, and they must have, because I have the papers here, that they changed the rules again so that I was no, that she didn't count as far as an exemption was concerned. But, so I was called, and I was sent to Detroit, and that's what the certificate of fitness is, for the physical exam. That's where everyone, you'd take the... Put us on a train in Grand Rapids and we'd stop in Lansing all the way, wherever there's any stops in Howell and so forth. And we'd go into Detroit, get in there in the morning, and we'd go through the line and take our physical exam. Then we'd go back home, and we'd get word later on whether or not we passed. Well, on April 14th, it wasn't until April 14th, 1945, that I received the certificate of fitness that I had passed, and I was put in the top rate 1A. And we had figured we were going to go, because we didn't know then that the war was going to end so soon. So we'd bought a house in 1939, I think, out in what was called Home Acres. It was a suburb of Grand Rapids, way out on the south side, out in Kelloggsville. So we were trying to get ourselves adjusted to be so that my wife and then Jim was born, then to her son. He was born in 43.
Now was your second child?
Yes. So that my wife and my two kids would be able to get by while I was gone. Well, anyway, then they changed the rules again, and if anyone was 30 years old and you had a child that was born before Pearl Harbor, then they put me back in the original. I was exempt. So I just sort of by the skin of my teeth was not drafted, and I was. And because Judy was born before the war, it's the only reason, because several of the other fellows that I worked with were drafted and served in the overseas, and both in the Pacific and the Atlantic areas. But that's the, as far as the war is concerned.
Let me ask you a question just then in terms of other co-workers and other people that RWDSU local, what was the number in 44?
Well, in 44, by then it was 386.
Okay. Other people were drafted.
Yes, people who were doing similar work were drafted.
Okay.
And the reason was because they did not have children that were born before Pearl Harbor, or before the draft took effect, I guess,
okay.
One or the other.
Because of that, how many members did the local represent, say, in 44, 45?
Well, we had, I would say the membership probably was 200, 225, something of that nature.
Okay. Who replaced? Did the membership change on you because of the war?
Not to a great degree.
Okay.
There were a few drafted, but not to the number, because of the semi-exemption, because of the...
Okay.
There weren't too many drafted,
okay.
But there were at least, maybe out of the whole local, maybe a dozen fellows were drafted, but
okay.
It didn't...
So you didn't have a major shift with
no.
More women coming in or new workers that hadn't worked there before, like black workers or Hispanics? Those
no. At that time, there was hardly any minorities working in the local. There may inside the bakery, there may have been a few, but they were not active.
Okay.
Do you want me to put this in that box?
Yeah. Okay. I'd ask you that because that was a major impact on a lot of CIO. Unions.
Mm-hmm.
So, did in Grand Rapids at all? Not thinking of your local, but you were already a delegate to the Grand Rapids CIO Council.
Yes, and when our local was chartered, the Roy Scoggins, who then had been appointed director of the RWDSU in Michigan, that probably happened in about 42 or 43. Before that, he was chairman of what we call the dairy division that we've mentioned before, and his associate was named George Worrell, George W-O-R-R-A-L-L. Now, in the struggle for the campaign that Scoggins and Gibbons and Steinberg led to try to unseat Walchuk, as the campaign started, Worrell and Scoggins were together. But Walchuk went around and his people went around the country making inroads. And the first one of the people that they got to desert the Gibbons, Steinberg, Scoggins campaign was Al Heaps, one of them. Al Heaps went back and supported Walchuk. And also in Michigan, they got George Worrell to support. Now that split our local right down the middle, because some of the very good active members were closer to George, at least for whatever reason, possibly because of settling grievances or something, than they were to Scoggins. In other words, so some of our key leaders of our local, Tom Kirkwood, for example, went with George Worrell. And when that split came between Worrell and Scoggins, Scoggins was fired immediately as the director, RWDSU director in Michigan, and all of us were fired. I had sort of forgotten that until I got these documents.
You were fired after the Akron 43 convention?
No, this was before the 43 convention. This was about in March, and there's some documents here that that shows that, that document that at a local meeting in Grand Rapids. This was in probably April of 1940. Was that 46? I got it here. Yeah, this was it must have been about April of 46 that Scoggins was fired, because we had a meeting in Grand...
April of what year?
Of 1946.
Okay, what happened in 43 Akron? I'm confused.
Well, the Akron convention, there wasn't, the convention in Akron wasn't until 1946.
Okay.
Here's a doc, and in about April of 46, as I mentioned before, Roy Scoggins was fired as the RWDSU representative or director in Michigan. George Worrell was on the payroll of the dairy division. Roy had been chairman and George Worrell was secretary of the dairy division. I guess Roy was listed as the president, but Roy was being paid by the International Union. And George was paid by the dairy division. And when Roy was fired, we were called in, myself from Grand Rapids, who was on the RWDSU staff, and Clyde Perkins from Lansing and Emil Willman from Saginaw. George Worrell called us in and said that if we would go with him in support of Walchuk and desert Scoggins, well, we could keep our jobs. But we all said no. We decided to stay with the Gibbons-Scoggins-Steinberg campaign, and so we were all fired. And so, but between the that time and the international convention, I'm trying to find the date of that, but that was later on. That was in May or June of 46. Yeah.
That was in Akron.
Yeah, in Akron, Ohio. So we, the three of us were fired. So what we decided to do was each of us would decided in order to keep the campaign going, we would go back to our local unions and see if the local unions would put us on the payroll, which they did. Our local union in Grand Rapids put me on the payroll. The Lansing local put Clyde Perkins on the payroll, and the Saginaw local put Emil Wellman on the local union payroll. But our local union, their other local unions are pretty solid. They didn't have the division we had. And so there was a campaign, Loyal Cameron, who was a Worrell supporter, was on the staff of the RWDSU too, and he worked all over, not just out of the local union. He and George Worrell came in and organized a caucus in our local union and tried to get the local to fire me. And this, the documents that I have here spells out what happened. Well, they were not successful. I was able to stay on the payroll of the local union until the convention. And we elected delegates that supported the Gibbons, Scoggins, Steinberg campaign, all of the delegates from our local. So we, even though they did put up a strong campaign and they had good trade unionists, but it was just a personality difference, because people were loyal to George Worrell. They were working for him.
Okay, now, in any of this, was any of this in RWDSU and the talked about in terms of right, left, communist, socialist?
In the RWDSU, it was not.
Okay.
It was not. It was strictly a pro-Wall Shock, anti-Wall Shock campaign. And then I think we have pretty well on the tape what happened before, what happened afterwards. That Gibbons went independent, Steinberg went independent for a year or so, and I think about 1949 or somewhere along there, they both went into the Teamsters Union.
Okay.
Scoggins, after the conventions, Scoggins soon dropped out of the picture and went into business with John Gibson and John Gibson's brother distributing beer. There's a beer distributor in, I'm not sure just where, but it wasn't in Michigan.
Who did this?
Scoggins? Roy Scoggins, yeah.
No. So at this...
In other words, he'd been fired and he lost. And he didn't have, because of the strong opposition, he couldn't have pulled the Michigan people out and went to go independent.
Okay.
And then, you see, after the convention, of course, I was out of a job entirely. And went back to the milk. That's when I went back to the milk route for a while. And for 2 or 3 weeks. And then the struggle started in the furniture workers. And Gus Show, who was president of the CIO in Michigan, I was on the executive board of the CIO, asked me if I would go on the staff to help try to keep the unions in the CIO, the United Furniture Workers, to fend off the raid of the Upholsters International Union, AFL. And I started out on the staff with that. That was my responsibility. But when that was over, Gus asked me to stay on, and I did, first as a representative, and then became education director when Bill Kemsley left in 1951.
Okay, well, we'll do all of that. But you were put on the staff of the Michigan CIO in 46.
46, yes.
Okay, by Gus, to keep locals in the furniture workers to hold off the raid by the upholsters.
Oh, the upholsters international, yeah.
There were not at this time fights between the furniture workers and the UAW.
No, during that fight, the American Seating Company, which was a unit, comes my wife, let me go there in.
You were about to tell me about American Seating.
Oh, American Seating was, of course, that was the largest unit, I think, and Local 415 of the furniture workers. They made, seating for stadiums and for just about theaters and everything under the sun. And it looked as though the furniture workers might not be able to hold them. So the UAW then, Leonard Woodcock and Ken Robinson, who later became regional director of Region 1D after Woodcock was elected vice president in 55. But anyway, Ken Robinson and Leonard Woodcock and the staff, the others on the staff there in Grand Rapids, decided to try to organize, try to move in on American Seating to keep it from, it was the only way they figured they could keep it, a CIO union, was to take it into the UAW, and many of the officers, John Annulis, who later became education representative of the UAW, was one of the local union, or unit officers of local, of the American Seating unit of Local 415. And they preferred the UAW. And so the UAW decided to try to organize it. And they did. And what you had was a three-way campaign. The furniture workers, CIO, and the UIU, Upholsters International Union, AFL, and the UAW. I worked with them on that campaign. We were over there hand-billing mornings and so forth. And the UAW won.
No.
Now, one of the reasons that the people, John Annulis and some of the other officers of the American Seating, they were fed up with the furniture workers as much as they were with the AFL, because the furniture workers was tainted so much with the communist branch or the communist influence of the unions. They had the furniture workers had organizers in Grand Rapids that was actively trying to sign up the local union members into the Communist Party. So they wanted to get out of that, and they didn't want to go to the UAW, or into the UIU. So that was one of the attractions of the UAW.
And so the accusation was that people on furniture worker staff we're trying to sign people up as party members.
That's right. And I know that's true because I talked personally with some of the...
Okay. You're part of the fight, or the CIO Kent County, though.
Mm-hmm.
That must have been a heck of an internal battle if you got two CIO locals. Right? They're both affiliated.
Well, yeah, it was, except that the because of the communist influence, most of the CIO council people were supported the efforts of the UAW.
What were the specific charges against the furniture workers in terms of misrepresenting the members of American Seating? Or
well, I don't think they, as I recall, I don't think there were too many specific charges about misrepresentation. I think it was strictly boiled down to the fact that the local union officers resented the UFW organizers that were in Grand Rapids following the left-wing line, and actually, and it was the communist influence in the unions at that time.
Okay. That helps clarify a lot. Now I know what to ask.
Now, I can give one specific example, the one I told you about before, if you want me to.
Give it to me again, yeah.
One time I had an occasion to go to Lansing with one of the furniture workers' officer, one of the local union officers of Local 415. This is before, when they were still in the furniture workers. And just a young fellow, local fellow in Grand Rapids who I knew very well, young, maybe 26, 27 years old. He was married and had two or three kids. And I knew that he was very nervous. I don't want to mention his name on the tape. But on the way home, we stopped in Portland. This is before the expressway was going through, and you had to drive through all the little towns. And there was a restaurant right by the river. I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, we always used to stop there and get a cup of coffee or something on the way home. And he was smoking cigarettes and very nervous. And he said to me, he said, I really got something bothering me. And he told me that the rep's name, and the rep's name was Ralph Williams, was trying to get him to sign a membership in the Communist Party. And he said, they're putting so much pressure on me that I almost wonder if I shouldn't sign it in order to get him off my back. Well, I strongly advised him against it, because I said, if you do, those people, the way they operate, is that they'll use that card to force you to do things that you just wouldn't do otherwise. And some of the things they might do would make copies of it and show it to some of the teachers where your kids go to school and things like that. Well, later on, he thanked me so very much for telling him that. He said, finally, I could see that it wouldn't be just getting him off my back. It might be something that would disrupt my whole life.
Okay.
And so, as I say, those are the things that made the people like this fella and John Angelus and others fed up with the furniture workers. And while they had some support on the CIO council, a majority of the support was with the move to go into the UAW.
Let me ask you one more quick question, then we can pass this by. I don't need his name for any reason. By this point, right at the end of the war, the last years of the war, were any of these people who were active in the Kent County CIO, did they see themselves at all? Some of them had roots in this, but I don't know if they still saw themselves as in any way connected to the Socialist Party or the Progressive Party or the Trotskyite Party or any of that.
Well, not in the Kent County CIO Council.
Okay.
We got into the Trotskyites in the CIO, in the state CIO Council.
And
of course, you had the movements of a lot of the socialist people with socialist background. Even Reuther and Leonard Woodcock and
right.
so forth in back in the 30s, you know, had sympathies to Norman and Thomas.
Right.
Campaigns and things like that. I don't know exactly, but I do know that Bill Kemsley was, I don't think he was a socialist, but he sympathized with a lot of the views of the Social Democrats, of course, and
yeah.
And I know after the war, they strongly supported the socialist governments of Western Europe, Social Democrats. It was in Germany,
but not in Kent County. This really didn't come.
There wasn't.
It didn't play out.
It didn't play. It didn't play an important role.
It wasn't CP versus Trotz versus SP or anything like
that.
The only
active political ones were the guys that came in from outside pushing the communists, the CPs.
Okay. Let's go back a few years before we lose some of this. What was the Kent County CIO doing during the war?
Well, as I said, I became a delegate soon after our local union was organized to the Kent County CIO Council. We had a little office on the west side. It was nothing but a store with a front where we had a mimeograph machine and a desk and didn't have any full-time people. I don't even recall they had a secretary. I think it was more a place where different unions could come in and they would do their own work.
Where was that, or is it still
that
there?
Was on Stocking Avenue. I can't think of the number, but it was on the west side of Grand Rapids on Stocking Avenue. And that's where I first met Leonard Woodcock. He was on Ruther's staff, the UAW. Ruther was the vice president at that time. And
he was on Ruther's staff, or he'd be on the UAW staff?
On Walter Ruther, he was on UAW staff, but he was working, he was on Walter Ruther. He was an assistant to Walter Ruther.
Okay.
And he came into Grand Rapids, and what he was sent in there originally for, specifically, was to organize the Fisher Body Division, or the Fisher Body Plant, which had been running since 1936, I think, but they'd never been able to organize it. They had heard rumors, and well, they were quite sure that the Christian Labor Association was trying to organize the plant, and the UAW thought it was very important to try to get that. Well, of course, this was about the time the war was starting and so forth. Well, anyway, they were successful. They won an election, I think it was 41, and continued and organized several locals in the Grand Rapids and Western Michigan area after that. But other unions too, the furniture workers, of course, and others, our union, after we got going, we used that office. But anyway, the Kent County CIO Council, we got started, and we had delegate meetings every month. And it was soon, one of the early campaigns that I can recall, the council being active in, of course, all the political campaigns. I was elected on the Political Action Committee, and in 1944, I was chairman of the Political Action Committee of the CIO Council. And in 1944, during the campaign for Roosevelt's fourth term, I was asked by John Gibson, president of the state CIO at that time, if I would work. I think I went on the staff in about June, until the campaign was over, to try to coordinate and organize the best campaign that we could in the Grand Rapids area, not only for Roosevelt, but for all of the candidates that Labor was supporting. And I did, and I have here, and I'll leave a copy of it, radio. I was asked to make a radio. One of the first radio talk I ever made was in support of the re-election of Franklin D. Roosevelt.
Is that a copy of your talk?
Yeah. That's here. And here's a letter from John Gibson dated November 9th, 1944. It's a copy of it. I don't know where the original is. Thanking me for serving on that campaign.
How many people were on the stand?
Well, and I was the only one on the staff of the CIO,
okay.
But of course the UAW, we worked with the UAW.
For Kent County?
Yeah.
Or that was the only person statewide for Gibson? Yeah.
No, I was the only one in Kent County. He had several others around the state in different areas that did the same thing.
And Gibson came out of what local?
The local 83 of the dairy workers.
Which
in Detroit.
Okay.
He had been secretary treasurer of the state organization while Gus was president. And Gus took a leave of absence as president in 1943, and Gibson was president from about 1943 to 45, before he went to Washington as Assistant Secretary of Labor.
Okay, so Gibson wasn't never in a situation of fighting against Gus.
No.
Gus left town for a while.
Gus took a leave of absence. He was on the National. Gus actually was served wearing two hats. He was regional director of the National CIO and also but paid by the National CIO, and one of the reasons was the state organization didn't have much money. But they membership increased to the extent that in Philip Murray wanted Gus to do some other things, so he took a leave of absence.
Okay.
And the reason he went back was when Gibson went to Washington, was they didn't know who to put on. There was quite a left-wing, right-wing fight in the UAW at that time, and always reflected into the CIO.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that the Reuther people thought they could hold the state CIO on their side was to put Gus back in. And so when Gibson went to Washington, I was on the board. We put Gus back in. Now I can also, as I say, one of the early campaigns I remember was, yeah.
Go ahead.
One of the early campaigns that I recall as a delegate to the Kent County CIO Council was there was a statewide campaign in Michigan to try to enact the Fair Employment Practices Act. And they had a very active NAACP unit in Grand Rapids, the chapter, I guess. And there was a president of a local attorney in Grand Rapids by the name of Floyd Skinner, who was the president of the local NAACP, and Mrs. Clater, Dr. Clater's wife, who was the widow of Earl Wilkins. Earl Wilkins was the brother of Roy Wilkins, who later became head of the National NAACP. Mrs. Wilson, when she came to Grand Rapids, married Dr. Clater, and she and Floyd Skinner and several others were very active in the organizing the campaign to try to get a Fair Employment Practices Act in Michigan. And I was on the Political Action Committee of the Council. Then I wasn't chairman, I don't think.
What year is this, 42 or 3?
This would be about 43. And we started a campaign to try to get the state legislature to pass the Fair Employment Practices Act. I'm kind of fuzzy on dates here.
That's okay.
When this was, but anyway, I remember several instances. Of course, the Grand Rapids chapter of the NAACP was very active. Roy Reuther came in, I know, and spoke at that meeting. And of course, the AFL-CIO supported the campaign.
AFL did?
The CIO Council supported the campaign. I remember, and I wrote these names down, one time, and the exact date here I'm not sure, but it was in the 40s during this campaign, and it went on for a few years. So we weren't successful right away. There was a woman in Detroit by the name of Olive Beasley who was very active, organizing the campaign statewide. And another young, very young fellow at that time, but he's still active. He works for SEMTA now, the Southeastern Michigan, by the name of Mickey Melser. They worked on the campaign statewide. And they had the Jewish Labor Committee, a good Jewish Labor Committee organized in Michigan. Mickey, as a matter of fact, then went on the staff. I think he was paid by the Jewish Labor Committee. But one day, I was driving down Ionia Street. They used to have a train that went from Grand Rapids to Detroit, and it would stop in Lansing and Brighton and a few places. And that was this was before the expressways were built. And we used to take that train all the time. You get on, it was a nice train, you could eat breakfast on it, and you could go home at night and eat dinner on the way home. But anyway, I went, and the train left in the morning, and it went to Detroit, and they also had a noon train. Train went 2 days One day, right about the time the train was coming in, for one reason or other, I don't know why, I happened to be driving down Ionia Avenue. And I spotted, I saw a guy that I, a UAW guy that I knew real well, a guy by the name of Tom Doherty. Mm-hmm. And he was with another fellow. I didn't know who the other fellow was at the time, but it turned out to be Oscar Cohen of the Jewish Labor Committee. And the reason they had come to Grand Rapids, and they were trying to flag a cab, and they saw me, and they said, will you take us out to Bishop Haas's home? And I said, sure. And then on the way out, they told me what they wanted. They wanted to ask Bishop Haas. This is Monsignor Francis J. Haas.
You like
Monsignor who?
Monsignor Francis J. Haas. I think it's spelled H-A-A-S.
And he...
He was the Catholic Bishop of Grand Rapids.
Okay.
And I might just say a few things about him. He was a very pro-labor, any good cause come along, he was for it.
How do you spell his name
again? H-A-A-S. Haas. Francis J. Haas. He had been appointed by Roosevelt, this is before he came to Grand Rapids, as a member of the War Labor Board. And he came into Grand, he was, the previous bishop had died, and Haas had been appointed bishop. And as I said, he was always on the side of the angels, to put it that way. And he was, I can remember specifically, during the General Motors strike, and was that 1946, a long strike they had? Mm-hmm. They had a rally at the Civic Auditorium in Grand Rapids, and one of the speakers was Bishop Haas. And I remember so very well that he made a wonderful speech in support of the strikers, really. And but he started out by saying that sometimes in controversies that you can't pick the good people from the bad people, but such is not the case with the strike of the UAW against the General Motors Corporation. The workers are right, and for these reasons. And it was a terrific.
Were you at that time practicing Catholics, or?
Well, my wife always was, and I got, of course, our office. Then we bought one of the early things we did in addition to the FEPC. The Kent County CIO Council coordinated the campaign to buy a union building in Grand Rapids. This was probably 43 and 44, and that was up at 215 Sheldon Avenue. It was an old, it was built, or it had been used previously by Davenport McLaughlin. Now they're still around in the business school. They have a school here in Lansing now. But they moved out to another location, and we bought that building. The local unions bought bonds, and I remember our local union, each member bought a $5 bond. We were just saying, give you a little certificate, but all it amounted to is you was buying a brick of the building. But anyway, we bought a building, and the building was right next to the chancellery office of the Catholic diocese there, and Bishop Haas was over there. He used to come into the office, and he would say, he always called me Mr. Stevens, and it made me feel funny. Here was just a young guy in those days, and he'd come in and ask, Mr. Stevens, what about this? But one particular time, I'm getting off the FEPC, one particular time, he came in and he says, Mr. Dubinsky's coming to town, Jake Dubinsky. And he said, now I've met him during my days on the War Labor Board and so forth, but I don't know him too well. I'm just wondering if you would take me down to the hotel and go with me up to meet him and then leave us alone. And I said, fine. So I went down and with him to the hotel. This is tied in with FEPC, because when I get to it, you'll understand why.
I understand.
So I went up to the room with him and chatted for a while, and I didn't know Jake Dubinsky. It wasn't Dubinsky. Dubinsky was other. It was Jake.
Closing workers?
Yeah. Potofsky. Jake Potofsky. Dubinsky was amalgamated with the garment workers, International Labor Garment Workers. It was Jake Potofsky. So we went up to Potofsky's room. Jake, if you ever seen pictures of him in those days, was quite a distinguished looking man. He had a little goatee and so forth. And anyway, so they chatted a while, and I said, well, I've got some things I've got to do. I'll be down in the lobby. When you're through, I'll take you back. I'll drive you back. I told the bishop, drive him back to chancery. So we went down, and while I was there, Martha Reynolds, who later became very active in the CIO, the UAW, she's on the UAW staff, but she was was in the lobby, and I was talking with her. Martha, she was active in the local NAACP too. But anyway, I said, I don't know what the meeting is all about upstairs, but anyway, Bishop Haas is meeting with Jake Potofsky about something.
Martha who?
Martha Reynolds. Bob Ripitz knows her very well. Martha was later, and when they started the community services camp organization in Michigan, the AFL-CIO Community Services, she was the first rep, the CIO rep in Grand Rapids, put on the staff to work on community services.
And at this, what local did she come out of?
She was out of a UAW local, I'm not just sure
in
which
Grand
one.
Rapids.
In Grand Rapids, yeah.
No problem.
I just mentioned her name because she was active in that FEPC campaign too, along with Florence Peterson and Kenneth Robinson of the UAW and others. But when finally Bishop came down and we were driving back to the hotel, he said, well, he says, I had a pretty good day. I got $1,000 out of Jake for the FEPC campaign in Michigan. So that's why he went to meet him. Just on a side and another issue entirely, one time the communication workers were coming to Grand Rapids to a convention, the national convention. This must have been in the early 50s. Bishop Haas came into the office again, and he said, here's where you get the mystery. He, Mr. Stevens, he says, the communication workers are going to be meeting here, and they've asked me to speak. He says, I don't know much about their union. I wonder if you could call down there. I understand that their offices are in, the convention is not until next week, and see if somebody would come out here and brief me on their union. So when I talk to their convention, I can, you know, mm-hmm. talk as though I know something about their union, a little more than I do now.
And it was CWA, it wasn't NFTW?
I think by then it was in the CIO, yeah. But then they had been independent before.
Okay, fine.
By that time they were in the CIO. And I said, sure, I'll call down there. So I called down to their office, Pentland Hotel. And they said, sure, we'll send someone out. And then they called back and they said, the president's coming out, Joe Byrne. Joe Byrne, the president of the CWA, was there. And so he, if anybody was going to talk to Bishop Haas, he wanted to, I guess. So Joe Byrne came out and he stopped at my office and I told him I'd take him over to the bishop, which was right next door. So we walked, over there and knocked on the door and went in and talked to the bishop. And he was sitting in his chair behind his desk, you know, and he says, yeah, he said, and I introduced Joe to him, and Joe just introduced himself to me because I'd never met him before. And he said, oh, he said, you know, he said, I didn't know too much, I'm Bishop talking now, too much about the communication workers, except some few months ago they had a strike, and all I remember is I tried to get Traverse City, and I couldn't get them, and I guess I leaned back and said, oh, damn, or something like that, you know. But anyway, so he started talking, and Joe was telling him about the union, and both got to rambling on, and got almost noon, and he said, how are you fellas, what are you fellas doing for lunch? Can you have lunch with us? And I said, well, I can. And Joe said, fine. So he said, all right. He said, you ride with me up to my house. I was up on Cherry Street. He had a big, long, black car of some kind that he always drove himself. And he was driving, and Joe Byrne's got in the middle, and I was sitting on the outside, the three of us. And he got to talking about, he said that somebody was advocating a national sales tax, you know, and he says, I heard it right on that radio, and he's driving down, and I'll never forget, he drove right through a red light. And Joe Byrne said, well, he says, I guess it's all right for riding with the bishop. But anyway, it was a very good session. Joe, and they got to talking about John L. Lewis, you know, and even though Lewis, of course, then was long out of the CIO, Joe Byrne's had admired Lewis, you know, for all the struggles that he'd put on. And so he went on to the convention and spoke. But anyway, this Bishop Haas was that kind of a person.
Okay. Quick question. You're sure this was CWA in early 50s?
Yeah.
Because I didn't know if an early 50s CWA strike. The one I know about was 46, 47, and 48.
Well, it may have been he was referring to the strike that might have even been a couple of years before that, you see, yeah. Yeah, I helped them with that strike, but at that particular strike, they were not yet in the CIO.
Right, that's why I was curious. Yeah. We'll get back to mm-hmm. that later.
Okay, well, anyway, so they went up to his, then we'll get back to Tom Doherty and Oscar Cohen that I met at the train. We're really rambling around here.
That's okay.
But I thought it would be good to have a little background about Bishop Haas, because he was
deceased,
he was a good influence to the community.
Yeah. Is that correct, Don?
What was that?
Monsignor Haas is deceased.
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay. That's what I said.
Yes, he died a few years later, and I remember Mickey Meltzer and Olive Beasley came up to the funeral. And the cardinal at that time was Cardinal Mooney. He came up and to the talked at the whatever they, you know, whatever they call it in the Catholic Church, the homily, I guess, at Bishop's funeral. He died probably in the mid-50s somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I took Oscar and Tom Doherty after I met him. This is another.
You picked up Tom Doherty
and Oscar Cohen.
And Oscar
down
Cohen
by the train, yeah.
At the train sometime around.
It was around noon.
In what year? Around.
Well, this was in about 44, 45, the mid 40s, when we were campaigning for the FEPC.
Okay.
And we drove, went up to the bishop's house. They had the appointment. Mm-hmm. And but they didn't know, they were looking for a cab, but Tom saw them, or I saw them, and I stopped. So I took him up there, and they told the bishop what they wanted. And they knew that he'd been active in the Grand Rapids, working with the NAACP and others, you know. And so he agreed to serve as, I guess, the honorary. His name was on, they more or less, he was active, but they had a staff, and so others, Olive Beasley was one of the key people on doing the legwork and so forth. And so he did, and we were successful ultimately. That was a campaign in the state of Michigan of passing a law, getting a law passed for an FEPC. And it was
before
during,
the federal one?
What was that?
Before the federal one was passed?
Well, I'm not sure if it was before or after.
Okay.
But anyway, we got it passed, and it was in the somewhere 49-50 there during the administration of G. Menon Williams, one of his early administrations. He was 6-time governor of Michigan.
Okay.
Well, that was a campaign that the CIO became very active in.
Okay.
And as I mentioned already, the 1944 election. Now I'll give you a side thing here too about Olive Beasley. Gus Scholl had a girl on his staff. First, she started out as a secretary, and later she went on full-time as a staff representative. Her name was Helen Graham, a black girl, and very, very sharp, very, very bright, and had all the right instincts and a tremendous person. But anyway, one time during this campaign, and this was again in the mid-40s, came to Grand Rapids to a meeting of some kind connected with the campaign for an FEPC. They came up on the train at noon and attended the meeting. They were going back there was a late train that left about 11 o'clock at night. But they had some time to kill after the meeting. The meeting got over with, say, about 9:30 or so, and so they came up to my office. I then was on the staff of the state CIO, but I worked out of Grand Rapids. I was also, at first I was chairman of the Political Action Committee, and later on, after the furniture worker fight, I became president of the Kent County CIO Council. But up until then, for a period of almost 10 years, when I was on the state CIO staff, I worked right in Grand Rapids. I was active
in the president of Kent County CIO?
In 1946.
Okay, we'll get to that later.
Yeah, and so I served three terms.
Okay, this is Graham and Beasley take a train.
All right.
They have time to
kill. Yeah.
You're on the state CIO.
So we were sitting in my office, and Helen, because Helen used to come with Gus, and we would go out to eat, you know, and that sort of thing. And she'd come up there just alone, and many times we would go. But anyway, she said, "Let's go down and how about buying us a drink?" So I said, "Okay." So we got in my car, and because I was going to take him to the station, the train didn't leave till 11 o'clock. You see, and we went down to a bar on where we quite often went,
What was that one? Do you remember the name?
What was this Smith's Bar? The thing.
The same one.
This is the same one, and it's the thing that stopped us from going there anymore. They were in front of me, and I was following along behind. There was a great big guy there, you know, a bouncer. He wouldn't let him in. And he says, "You can't come in." And boy, Helen spoke up and said, "Well, how come?" He said, "Well, we don't allow it." She says, "Why? Because we're girls?" She says, "There's a lot of girls in there. I can see them." But anyway, it was because they were black. And they talked for a while, and I said, "Well, what do you suggest we do?" And they said, "Well, I think we've made our point, and I don't think we want to cause a scene out here in the streets and so forth. So let's go back to your office." So they did, and then I took them to the train. And so that was the end of going to Smith's Bar. We went to other places after that.
This was after the war.
Yeah.
And before Williams became governor?
Well, it was probably, it may have been in either the late 40s or early 50s.
Okay. I'm going over to Judy for a little bit. I'll be right back.
Oh, yeah. Also, I think I'd like to say something about is the University of Michigan School of Workers that they did establish, but then it was junked because of politics.
What do you want to say about the U of M School?
Well, there again, through the CIO Council, we had an education committee, and I was put on that too. And one of the reasons we had an education committee was because in early 1940, the University of Michigan was attempted, and they did establish a school for workers. They hoped to pattern it after the University of Wisconsin, a school for workers that had been going on for some time then, I guess. And there's one of the active people that came to Grand Rapids, and I don't know if he was director of the program or not, was a guy by the name of Arthur Elder. And on his staff was another person by the name of Stoyan Menton. S.D.O. Stoy, we called him, Stoy Menton. He was at MSU for a while when he first started the center.
They came to Grand Rapids?
They came to Grand Rapids to organize some classes, collective bargaining, storage training, and to tell about the workers' education program. This was in about 44, 45. And we had, they set up several good classes. They would organize the programs. And Stoy came in and taught a class in storage training, as I recall. I attended that class. And they were conducting programs of that kind all over the state. And also, the state CIO became very active in education, and Bill Kemsley right there. In 1944, went on the staff of the CIO as education director.
Of
the Michigan State AFL-CIO. Gushel hired him as education director.
Where did he come out of?
He came out of Local 174 in Detroit, Walter Reuther's local. He was active in the early days along with Reuther and Vic Reuther.
Right.
He and Vic were very close. They were in Paris together at that time. Just later on, but anyway, so they in the University of Michigan worked with them in establishing a summer school over in Western Michigan at a place called Camp Chief Noonday. And when I was elected to the executive board of the CIO, we had our first meeting, and we were sworn in to office, all of us newly elected people, along with Gus Scholl, who then had became Gibson. Gus came in later. Gibson was president of the state CIO yet, I guess. And Barney Hopkins, who had been elected secretary treasurer, and the new board were sworn in over at Camp Chief Noonday. They had 2-week school over there. It was a state-owned facility. About to 30, 40 miles from Grand Rapids, out between Grand Rapids and Kalamazoo someplace. It was a good school. This was 40 years ago, or almost 40 years ago. And they ran classes in labor history and all the different things that we always ran in those days in the early schools.
Who taught labor history, remember?
They had Not whether it was at this school or not, but one of the first guys that I remember teaching labor history and labor economics too was Sam. God, he was killed in.
That's okay.
Well, it may come to me, but along with the Bill was director of the state CIO, and a guy by the name of Joe Kowalski was a director of education for the UAW in Michigan. And they sort of were the state council and the UAW ran the school together. Well, we held our school over there for 2 years. After that, in 1946, there'd always been opposition to labor education. I wish I could hear it, think of his name, a guy by the name of Sam Jacobs, who was from the teachers union, but he took classes for the U of M program, and he worked for the UAW too. Sam Jacobs was teaching a class in labor economics, and he also taught labor history. The sessions that I took in labor history, the first ones I remember was Sam Jacobs, but his main pitch was in labor economics.
Is 45 or 46 the same?
Well, this was 44-45 period.
Okay.
Sam was teaching a class, and of course they were open. You couldn't keep people out. And the UAW, not the UAW, but General Motors Corporation, and as I recall, I think Bell Telephone Companies, sent some people into the class, and they made. And this was had to be 46, after 46, because a fellow by the name of Kim Sigler was elected governor of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And the General Motors Corporation complained that the UAW was teaching socialism and so forth, and they got a hold of the governor of Michigan and said that they wanted the governor of Michigan to get the university to stop the programs. And they didn't like the kind of economics that was being taught. So the governor of Michigan called the president of the University of Michigan, whose name was Alexander Ruthven, and asked him if he wanted to meet with the Board of Regents. And I'm quite sure they met right in the governor's office. But anyway, the governor laid it out. He says, I want this program killed. And Ruthven, president of the university, said, absolutely not. But anyway, the Board of Regents had 8 members. They were all Republicans in those days. And they voted that day, 7-1 to kill the program. There was one Republican from Kalamazoo by the name of Alfred Conable, who voted along with the president. Now, the president of the university Alexander Ruthven was a wonderful person. I mean, a great person. He wasn't going to be about to be pressured. But he only had one vote on the Board of Regents, so that university program was killed, dead in its tracks. So we had no labor education program, and among other things, following that, we were notified by the camp Chief Noonday, the people in the state that we had to contact, that we no longer could rent their camp. So the UAW and the state AFL-CIO, or not, I keep saying AFL-CIO, so it was state CIO then, decided that, well, we had to have a summer school. So they bought a camp. They decided to buy a camp. And at the convention, it's in that some of the stuff I'm going to give you. They passed a resolution at the state CIO convention in 1946 to buy the property up north of Port Huron, and later became known as the F. Franklin Delano Roosevelt Labor Center. And we held schools there for 20 years. And then when the UAW finally started to buy their own property and so forth, mm-hmm. So it was decided not to. There was 2 reasons. After the University Michigan program was killed, we no longer were welcome at the universities. So, in order to keep our education program alive, it was decided to have our own facility. But then, in about 1949 and 50, after the war. Brendan Sexton and Bill Kemsley there. I was on the staff of the CIO, they got the idea that let's go see John Hanna, Michigan State University.
When's that?
Well, it was about the early 50s.
Okay. Why don't you
it took, these were just discussions. It took quite a little while before then we can maybe come back to it. But anyway. Yeah.
Go ahead, finish your thought. You're welcome
there. So Hanna sort of liked the idea, and because for two reasons. He thought that it was proper to have labor education programs, and he also figured it was a good way to stick a knife into the University of Michigan, you know. And so anyway, we kept talking with him, and they'd meet with him occasionally, and we had some conferences there, and at the university. We used the university, but we would supply all the staff and everything. Well, finally, later on in about 1955, I think it was 53 or 54, he agreed to establish what he called the Center for Labor, I think it was Center for Labor Education. But he said he kept it right in his office. It wasn't put in any department of the university. He said, I want it, you know, right here where people can't jump on it. So, and then that's where Stoy Metten came in. And Vic Ruther and Bill Kemsley strongly urged the appointment of Stoy Metten. And this was about 43, I think. Either late 43 or early 44. And Stoy came for a while, and he stayed there, and Fred Haler came in 1955, the year of the merger. So I remember first time I ever met Fred Haler. I was at a education conference of the CIO and the AFL, joint education conference, just before a merger of the two organizations. And we were meeting at a hotel. We were in a bar in the hotel, and Brendan Sexton and Fred Haler. I knew Brendan, of course, but I didn't know Fred. But they were arguing like the devil. Brendan didn't think it was the right thing to do to merge at that time, and Fred thought it was. Well, anyway, after the meeting, I remember Fred said to me, he says, there would be a good guy to take over the labor program at Michigan State. They figured that the university was not going to accept Stoy when they decided to make it a permanent organization. So anyway, that's out of that came an interview set up with Woody Varner, who was vice president then at MSU, and Fred Haler was hired. So just a little bit about the development of labor education programs in universities.
Yeah. I was going to save it for a couple weeks from now, but this will give me some
You might want to get back to it after a while. Okay. Then make a note if you want to, so that we can tell about how the University of Michigan got back in the program.
Why don't you tell it to me right now?
Okay. We were, Brendan then, at that time, was Director of Education for the UAW. And he'd been meeting with some people at the University of Michigan. This was after 1955, because the Democrats had elected some members to the University of Michigan Board of Regents. One of them was a fellow by the name of Eugene Power. And Brendan talked with a few people on the staff that he knew there, they set up a meeting at Eugene Power's house. And this, as I say, was probably 56, about that time. And we went out there and met with them, and finally they decided to set up the program that's going now, that High Corn Blues is associated with, that you were with for a while, and to bring in, Brendan suggested Larry Rogan, who before that was with the textile workers. And Larry came in and established a program at the University of Michigan that's going now. So, I mean, then after that, Wayne came in with a joint program. Meetings followed with Ron Houghton at Wayne State University, Ronald Houghton. And the University of Michigan and Wayne decided to go together, so that's why you have the joint U of M Wayne State University program.
And then when you reset it up, you still didn't have majority Democrats at U of M. What convinced them?
Well, let me give you the first example at Michigan State. They were all, when they first set it up, they were all Republicans. The Democrats weren't elected until 55. There was one Democrat, Connor Smith, who'd been appointed by Governor Williams. See, if anyone dies or retires from a board, the governor fills the appointment. Connor Smith was a veterinarian from Pinconning, Michigan. But the rest of them, there was only six on the MSU board at that time. They called it the State Board of Agriculture because it was a land-grant college. But there were five Republicans, and one of the Republicans, Clark Brody, was the head of the Farm Bureau in Michigan, and Forest Acres, or the golf course is named after, was an official of the Chrysler Corporation, and Fritz Mueller from Grand Rapids, who later became Secretary of Commerce in Eisenhower. These were the conservative Republicans. Well, Hannah said Dr. Edgar Hardin, who later became president of Northern Michigan University and then for a while at MSU after Wharton left, but Dr. Edgar Hardin in those days was dean of continuing education at Michigan State University. Hannah had been president, of course, for since the early 40s, but during the Eisenhower administration, he had been appointed assistant secretary of war. And he was in Washington, but he hung on to the presidency. But Hardin, and MSU had no vice presidents at that time. Hannah was the whole, even when he was assistant secretary of war, did they call it war or defense? I don't know. Assistant Secretary of Defense, I guess, yeah. He would come in here. He would fly back and forth and run his office here, yeah. But Hardin was actually his lieutenant, but he was not a vice president, but he was dean of continuing education.
But he ran the show, you're saying?
Yeah, he was the top lieutenant here. Hannah ran the show, but Hardin was the top.
Are you ready
lieutenant.
For lunch?
Not quite.
We'll holler in just a minute.
Okay.
And so they said, well, we got to, how are we going to sell this thing? This was told to me afterwards. The two of them get to, how are we ever going to sell this thing to the board? State Board of Agriculture. Well, anyway, they, Hardin, I don't know all the particulars, but they took them one by one and so forth and told them that convinced that Republican conservative board that it was a good idea and they got it approved. And the University of Michigan only had a couple Democrats, six Republicans, and I think pretty much the same. By that time, Ruthman had left, and there's a fellow by the name of Hatcher. Harlan Hatcher was president of U of M. He didn't like the idea of U of M being behind Michigan State, you see. And so I think they sold the Board of Regents on that basis, and you know, so forth. And they'd sort of gotten over the anti-labor feeling of 46. See, in 46 election in Michigan, 46 was a sweep. That was after Roosevelt had died and Truman became president. And the Michigan legislature, to give you an example how bad it was, in those days there was 100 in the State House representatives. Out of that 100, 95 Republicans were elected, only 5 Democrats. And in the Senate, there were only either 2 or 3 Democrats. I think there was a total of 8, 5 in the House and 3 in the Senate. So, and there was a great move during those 2 years of Kem Sigler was elected governor to pass anti-labor legislation, and they did. They passed the so-called Hutchison Act and the Bonine Tripp Act, and all of them were laws limiting labor's rights. So that's, but by mid-50s and so forth, that had sort of subsided. And
I was going to ask you about anti-labor legislation a little later, Pam Tarpley's predecessors here. Yeah. Who was Sigler's predecessor?
Harry Kelly, a Republican, but a decent sort of a Republican.
Yeah. And
Sigler was a, Kem Sigler only served one term. He was one of the flamboyant guys. You know, he flew his own airplane and he walked around, you know, and boy, he was a distinguished looking guy. But he made a lot of enemies. He was one of these guys that turned people off. And it was probably the thing that helped Williams win election more than anything else.
Okay. So the program, the historic program at U of M that helped the Republicans or whoever, GM, get rid of labor ed for a number of years was the U of M's CIO summer school out in Grand Rapids?
Well, the U of M only participated. You see, it was sponsored, the school was actually ran by the CIO Council State Council, and the UAW. Bill Kemsley there and Joe Kowalski were the two co-directors there. Now, it was a statewide school, but just happened to be held over there near Grand Rapids. Now, the U of M, where the U of M Workers Program Service come in, and that Art Elder was there teaching a course, I don't know just what, Stoy Benton was there. And so we were there for 2 years, and then when they would no longer rent us facilities, that's why we bought the camp at FDR, and that we operated our schools there for 20 years.
Okay, and we can pick up on that later. Should we go?
Go ahead, Bunty. I was mentioning that Bob Reapus had some run-ins with Hannah, and
yeah.
Different than...
Well, but before you put the tape on, let me just tell you one. After the Labor Program Service had been established in 1955, really, when Fred Haler first came. Mm-hmm. It operated for a couple of years before that, as Hannah always used to said, out of his vest pocket, out of his office. Then it became a center, and when Fred Haler came, and that operated along. Bob Reapus came in soon after Fred hadn't been here too long before he brought Bob Reapus in.
Mm-hmm.
We had known Bob because he used to come to the FDR camp,
mm-hmm.
when he was working for the American Friends Service Committee back in the late 40s and early 50s. But in 1958, the state of Michigan was really strapped. And it was so, Williams was governor, and he was having a terrible fight with the Republican legislatures. Both House and Senate were controlled by the Republicans. And trying to get enough money to keep the state going. And I was on the board, and we had a majority of Democrats. And I think there were two Republicans on the board. But anyway, Hannah decided to... Well, they had to cut, you know, in order to have enough money to go around. The state was so strapped that for a while they missed paydays. I remember the payless paydays, they called them. Well, anyway, they finally got through it by passing a bunch of patchwork taxes on cigarettes and everything. They didn't pass an income. We didn't have a state income tax then. and they got over that hurdle, but Hannah would come in with several recommendations that cuts be made, and two of the cuts that were newly established programs, and one was the Labor Center for Labor Industrial Relations, as it was known as then, and the other was the Highway Traffic Safety Center. And I it's one of the things that I feel as though my presence on the board was able to save the program, because I argued that the labor program should not be discontinued I put forth all the usual reasons why, and because the university was servicing all other segments of society, helping to train people for the banks and the businesses and everything else, and it's only fair that the leadership of unions shouldn't receive the same kind of, or at least some, through their continuing education programs, some support. And the board agreed, and Hannah backed off, and the center was not was killed. I can't remember. The Traffic Safety Center wasn't either. Others, I guess, spoke up in support of that. Then on another occasion, President Hannah, who was he's a very smart person. He's smart enough to know when times are changing. And I think that's the reason that he agreed, one of the reasons he agreed to establishing a workers' education program at Michigan State. Because he could see that the Democrats had been starting to win some election, and it was no longer a conservative or Republican bias on, and he knows that the university has to have some support from the segments of the community that are riding with the times. But anyway, I forget just what the controversy was, but Bob Reapus got into some hassle at the university, and that he was fighting for something, and I can't remember what it was. I'm sure Bob would know. But anyway, it was come time for for Bob to be appointed for his tenure status was coming up. And Hannah's come right out for the board, and he said he didn't want to give Repas tenure. Well, I argued against it, and my majority of the board were agreeing with me. And Hannah, as I say, was smart enough to know that he was going to lose that battle. So Bob proceeded and got his appointments and was actually moved up to the academic program as he should have been. But if Hannah had had his way, and if the board had been the kind of a board that would have agreed with him, why Bob's tenure thing would have been stymied at that time.
I think that's one of the stories. The other one, Repas, is only mentioned in passing to me, and I've got to talk to him on tape sometime, was there was some kind of a state of Michigan House of Representatives person who led some kind of internal investigation after the Labor Center was established, after Repas was on board, into, and I can't remember if it was for kind of one of these stories about communism or socialism being in there, or if it was not that, but something else that anyway, some conservative Republican.
Well, now here's what, I'll tell you what it was.
And I can't remember because I've never talked to
I'll tell you what it was. They made a film.
That's what it was.
They made a film.
Tell us about that.
State Labor Body.
Right.
I remember we used to have, when I was education director of the CIO and then the AFL-CIO, we had schools around the state. So Michigan's a big state, and there's a lot of steel workers, and we had some communication workers, and a few auto workers and so forth in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. And we, every year, we would hold a week, sometimes a two-week school in the Upper Peninsula. Periodic, sometimes we would hold it at Northern Michigan University. Northern Michigan later had a sort of a tie-in with U of M. But anyway, another time we would have it over at Weber's Resort. And soon after Fred came here, we were having we always had them either the fall or the winter time, but usually around the fall of the year. We had our Upper Peninsula School at Weber's Resort over near Ironwood, Michigan. It was about 30 miles east of Ironwood, Michigan, on Lake Gogebic. Marinesco was the name of the little town right close by. And so Fred and I went up ahead of time, and some of the other staff, and Fred and I went out in a boat. And I remember he was rowing the boat, and he was talking and so forth. He came up with this idea of the center. I think it was still called the center at that time. But then after a while, it was changed into the School of Labor Industrial Relations. But anyway, we'll say the center or the school, whichever it was.
Catch any fish?
Well, we weren't really fishing. We were just rowing around the lake looking at things. And he said, come up with this idea of the school, or of the film. It's called a state labor body. In other words, to explain the function of a state labor council. And he wanted to know what I thought of it, and if I thought Gus would support it, and so forth. So anyway, that's where the idea started. And we went to the state, he came to the state CIO executive board and got an appropriation of something to help finance it, I think. And so they put out the film. They spent a lot of time on it. They had a guy, I can't think of his name, he used to go around and take pictures of everything under the sun. They dealt with the camp a lot. And it was pretty well described, the film. And anyway, it was shown
Repas
up.
Was involved in creating the film?
What was that?
Was Repas?
Well, Repas was, he was active. I can't just remember what his role was, but he was
okay.
Active on the thing.
Okay.
And so somebody, and I can't just remember where it was either, but I guess it was in the Upper Peninsula.
Uh-huh.
Started raising the cane with the legislature.
A representative, right?
Yeah, with a state representative. About now I'm getting it's all coming back to me now. Yeah, I can't remember who the state. Oh, I know one of them was from the Upper Peninsula, and the other was a state senator from Flint, or not Flint, Midland. State senator from Midland. What the hell is his name?
That's the one Bob's mentioned.
Yeah, state senator from Midland. He was a John Bircher, if there ever was one, but. They came into the legislature. Bob wouldn't know the name. You can get it there. Maybe it'll come to me in a minute.
That's okay.
And they got both houses in the House of Representatives and the Senate to pass a resolution to kill the labor program because of that film. It wasn't a bad film, really. But anyway, Hannah, to his credit, they called him down, and Bob has that, I've seen it. They called him down to, I used to have the documents on that too. Hannah went down before a committee of either the State House or the State Senate, and to his credit, boy, he defended that, the labor program, and he defended the film. And so that blew over. But anyway, so we continued the program, even though the state legislature ordered the university not to. The Board of Trustees, and with Hannah's support, just continued, ignored the lid, because they, under Michigan Constitution, the state, and they couldn't do anything about it except maybe threaten to withdraw funds from some other areas
of
the university.
So you ignored the resolution, which stayed in effect?
The resolution, as far as I know, whether it was either rescinded or not, I don't know, but the Board of Trustees just continued the program as if nothing ever happened.
What year were you elected trustee?
I was elected trustee in 57. I took office January 1st, 1958. But this controversy didn't happen until over in the 60s sometime.
Okay.
Into a little bit about this expulsion resolution I was telling you about.
Whose expulsion?
Well, during the war, this is 1963.
Go ahead with it if you're thinking about it.
This happened in 63. Something happened. It was before the demonstrations on campuses and so forth.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
But there was a... No, I'm getting things screwed up. The 63 controversy was speakers. There was an organization on the campus that invited two left-wing speakers to the university. And I was in Detroit to a meeting, and I got a call from president's office saying that president wanted to call a special meeting because he wanted the board to support him in refusing to let those two speakers speak.
President Hannah.
President Hannah. Well, so they had the meeting, and I had the hunch that something was like that was happening. Something was under. So I wanted to get somebody at the university because I just barely had time to get there because I wanted to be on record against, barring the speakers. And so I called Fred. I got a hold of Fred, and I said, Fred, will you work on a resolution that I can have, because I know what they're going to do. Hannah's going to recommend that we bar them from the university. And I think he's probably got the votes, but I want to be on record against it. So he just dropped up a statement saying that if free speech means anything, it should certainly mean something on a university campus. So we had the meeting, and Hannah sorted it out. He said that because of the threats of the legislature cutting appropriations and all that sort of thing. And so I voted against it, but I was the only one. Even all the other Democrats voted with Hannah on it. So they did. They voted to bar the speakers. Well, so what happened was an organization that has a fraternity that had their office down, or their house down on the river, they invited they organized the meeting, and they had the speakers come in, and they had great, great big turnout on the banks of the river. So in other words, the speakers did come.
Who were the speakers?
I can't think of their names. Repus probably knows. It's in all the records there at the university. But they were left-wing speakers. I don't know whether they're communists or whatever they were. But anyway, they were. And so that was the one. Now because this is later on, during the demonstrations.
That's the expulsion, this new one.
Yeah.
Okay, whatever happened to the fraternity?
Well, no, nothing. The fraternity, they felt very proud of themselves, in other words, the university, we're going to bring the speakers here, even if, now I
Bob wasn't the faculty advisor to the fraternity.
I don't know what Bob was active in most all of these things, if he was around here. Sometimes he was on sabbatical, so he missed out on everything. But on the speaking on the freedom of speech idea. Mm-hmm. About the same time, there was a United States Senator from Mississippi by the name of Ross Barnett, very old reactionary guy, and the president of Western Michigan University at that time was a fellow by the name of Jim Miller, who was from MSU and had been secretary of our board of trustees briefly before he was appointed president of Western. Ross Barnett had been invited to speak at Western by some organization, some conservative organization. And Jim Miller, even though Jim Miller was a liberal, but this organization, some of the liberal groups, so-called liberal groups, but they weren't really thinking, they wanted to bar Ross Barnett. I don't know whether they were liberal, just exactly who. It wasn't the Civil Liberties Union or anyone like that, but just some people said, why do we want this guy up here? Well, Jim Miller stood right out by the door there, making sure that the people that wanted to come in could come in. And he made it clear. He says, I don't agree with Ross Barnett, but I agree with his right to speak, mm-hmm. if a group wants him to come. I mean, so the philosophy there, and he stood up for it. But then just a few of the highlights of the service on the Board of Trustees. During the demonstrations, and this must have been in 68, 67, 60, early demonstrations, there was some sort of a demonstration over in the administration building that a bunch of students went in the administration building and sat down and were demanding certain things. And
this is anti-war demonstration.
Yeah, anti-war demonstration. And Hannah didn't like the idea, but he didn't do anything. He wanted to be sure he always wanted to get board approval because, so what he wanted to do was to be able to point out the ringleaders, have people put the finger on the ringleaders. He wanted to expel them from school. So he called to come up at the regular board meeting, as a matter of fact. You know, right out of the blue. We used to know there was no open meetings law or anything in those days. And I think we were meeting, and just the board and over the press and everything had left, and he hauls out a resolution. He read, passed it around, you know, and I read that resolution. I thought, what the heck is this now? And what the resolution said, in effect, was, it's a long, drawn-out thing, but it boiled down to the fact that the president had the right to expel any student at his own wish. Whenever he thought it was appropriate, the president could expel him. Well, they got to talking about it, and everybody, of course, agreed, you know. I said, well, I don't know. I said, I have my doubts. And Claire White, who was kind of a wild character, and he's a real screwball, he's so screwy that he ran with for lieutenant governor with this Tisch, you know, this last year. I mean, that's to follow through his screwball.
He was another trustee.
But he was listening to me, and he voted with me. Claire White and I voted against the expulsion resolution. Well, so, but nothing was said, you see. Then Hannah took it in and so forth. And then after the meeting, I walked out, and there was a kid there from the state news. And I said, say, he said, why don't you, I said, why don't you get a copy of that resolution we just passed that Claire and I voted against. So anyway, they got it. How the hell they get it? Maybe I give them mine, I don't know. But so they took it over to the student council and around the university and so forth, and to some of the faculty guys like Walter Adams and Lash LaRue and some others, and boy, people started really getting up on nothing. It was almost unanimous with the faculty, the students, and everybody else that was against the resolution because it just didn't make sense. Well, so I was home one night, and I got a call from the officers of the student council, the president, the vice president, I think it was a guy by the name of Harvey Zoden, D-Z-O-D-E-N or something like that. he said, would you meet with our board? Would you meet with our board? The president, incidentally, was a lawyer, and became Milliken's legal advisor. But I saw Harvey, and we were meeting with the whole board out at a restaurant out there in Okemos. We lived in Okemos, and they said, well, we're going to try and promote a rally, and would you speak at this rally? Bob was there because I remember So I said, sure. So I got up, and anyway, I gave a speech, and Lashler, they took movie pictures of this thing, you know. And they used to, after a few years later, they were using it when they had the seniors that had enrolled in the university, you know, they have these, what do they call them, orientation sessions. They show this film. They'd always show Lashler and me up there on top of the rock, you know, demonstrating free speech. But so we both spoke saying that this is the wrong kind of a resolution. The president should not have authority to expel students. They have a right to due process, you know, and to find out whether they're guilty. At least if they're innocent, let them have an opportunity to prove their innocence. And they had a big turnout. But anyway, Hannah had been to some meeting. He was always going to meetings. He was serving on the state, on Eisenhower then was president on the, wait a minute, no, it wasn't Eisenhower, it was Johnson by that time, but he'd started out when Eisenhower was president on the Civil Rights Commission. And I think he was attending a meeting of the Civil Rights Commission. And I think when he got back, he said, it looked kind of silly for me to come back from the Civil Rights Commission and have all this publicity about an expulsion resolution. So he called a meeting of the board, and by God, they unanimously reversed, you know, reconsidered the thing and threw it out. But it was an exciting.
So Hannah really had tremendous control over this board in the late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah, well, you did, unless somebody would speak up, you know. And here was a case, you know, I used the case of the freedom of speech, and they finally reversed that too later on, where they wouldn't allow the speakers to come in, and the expulsion resolution. See, the fact that I, in this case, Claire White joined with me. And we got the support of the university community.
Did labor get at all involved in either of these stories?
No, I don't think so. I think because it all happened so quick, you know, that we didn't.
Okay.
Another, you know, this goes way back to the first year I was on the board, 1958. Bob Ripas was active. Bob Ripas and Bob must have been there. Lash LaRue, I think Bob was involved. In those days, ROTC was compulsory, and they were trying to get a support among the university community and try to get the board to adopt a policy that ROTC would be voluntary. Oh, Hannah was against that, boy.
Why?
Well, he says it's a good thing. He says it supplies all the officers in case we need them in time of war. And he would use the example, it's a good leveler. Every male student had to take ROTC in those days. Well, anyway, and the Secretary of the Army then was a guy by the name of Wilbur M. Brucker. He's the former governor of Michigan in the early 1930s. And, you know, they brought in a show in here, and they tried to convince the board to support compulsory ROTC. And they took the board. I went on a trip down to El Paso, Texas, and around showing all the installations and so forth, and trying to demonstrate the need for officers and that the universities should have compulsory ROTC. Well, anyway, they voted to continue for compulsory ROTC, but I voted against it. And I don't know if anybody joined me or not. I rather doubt it. I think I'm probably the only one that voted against it. But then, this was when Eisenhower was still president. This was about 69, 70. And then when Kennedy was president, of course, Brucker went out and McNamara came in. And then from high, McNamara's office, Secretary of Defense, was strongly urging the university to go voluntary. So then, along with most of the other universities in the country, that's when voluntary ROTC started.
Mm-hmm. Well, certainly when we get to that part, that part of your life about the board, you could tell me.
And we're going back, you say, to 44?
Why don't you say go back?
A little bit in here about the labor, about the efforts.
In a book on Grand Rapids.
Yeah, on an efforts to organize the, and the mayor was a friend of union. The unions were broken. They weren't successful, but it makes a point in this book. I was surprised that the mayor stood up with the unions.
Okay, maybe I can write down the title of that.
Dissension in the Ranks. Put some kind of a mark in that.
Union, the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners, on April 11th, more than 700 furniture workers walked off the job. I mentioned the plants and so forth. The mayor was George Ellis, George Deacon Ellis. Mayor from 1906 to 1916.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, through history, and guys like that prop up.
Yeah. Going through pictures.
Well, this isn't just pictures. It's some of the documents I have.
Okay.
This is a picture, though. It was with the State Convention of 1944, and this is a picture of delegates from Grand Rapids to that convention.
Okay.
And myself and Ray Powell, Ed Tilma here, and the other two. I think they were all local 730 delegates, except me.
Okay, I'm going to leave this with you to write the names on the band at some point, okay?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The ones I know, yeah.
The ones
I'll take them down, yeah. And this is my